Thanks to the participants for sharing their stories. Thanks also to the Institute for Anarchist Studies, to PM Press, to the Marla Davis Fund, to KABU Community Radio, and to the rest of our production team, Icky A., Julie Perini, and Mo Bastern. And thank you for listening.
KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
Can't get good reception of KABU on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. KABU's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. Masks and proof of vaccination are required at this time. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kabu.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KABU
Radio on KBOO Portland. I am your host, Michael Cathcart. My regular co-host, Elliot Gilliland, could not be here for this episode, but luckily we have a wonderful guest lined up for you folks tonight. But just quickly before we get into that, I would like to give a special thanks and shout out to the Labor Radio Podcast Network for hosting podcasted versions of our show each month. Be sure to check them out at laborradionetwork.org. And now we are going to be discussing again, as we did last month, the Writers Guild strike. As most listeners are probably aware, the Writers Guild of America, or the WGA, has been on strike since the beginning of May. And they are, you know, they are the industry group that represents all television and movie writers. And they are currently on strike in opposite or being opposed by the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, or the AMPTP, which is the industry group that represents the executives of major Hollywood studios, as well as the major streaming platforms such as Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and, you know, so many others. And those two groups failed to reach a deal on a new minimum bargaining agreement by the May 1st deadline. And that led to the Writers Guild, the Writers Guild to call for its first strike since 2007. There are major issues that there are a few major issues that are driving the strike. The big ones are basically pay scales, residual fees, and base employment guarantees. And we will be getting into, you know, some of the depths of what those issues involve. But first, before we get into that, I would just like to introduce my guest. My guest is a writer, and she has been a writer for nearly 30 years, a television writer, has also written movies. Her name is Ruth Bennett, and she also happens to be my mother. So welcome to the show, Ruth.
Well, that hasn't been proven, but thank you. I'm right here. Glad to be
welcome.
Here.
I appreciate you joining. And you are someone who has been in the industry and has seen it from many sides, but, you know, really specifically from the writing and kind of, you know, and worked through kind of the golden era and the heyday of being a television writer. And, you know, so you've seen it at its best and you're now seeing it at potentially its worst. And so I think you can provide some great insight for us. Before we jump into, you know, the the issues that are currently at stake for the writers. It would be great if you could just provide us some background as to, you know, your experience as a writer and how you got into Hollywood and the work that you did there.
Well, being a child of the 60s, I mean, coming to age in the 60s, I just felt if I wanted to do something, I could do it. And I don't know if that's the feeling now, but at one point, I always wanted to be a writer. And at one point, I decided, well, sure, I'll just go to Hollywood and become a TV writer. And people looked at me like I was crazy, and I was. But I was also very lucky. And I went there. I lived in Boulder, which is was the hippie young people capital at the time. I'm giving my age away. And I'm not going to tell the whole story, but I did manage to get a very hungry agent who would do anything to get a young client in the door, and he did, and gave me a great first credit. And he said, you're going to go in and pitch this brand new show. I think it's going to be good, and, you know, it could give you a leg up in your career. And he was right, and the show was called Taxi. And it was a great show. And I remember I wrote one of the first, I think it was number 4 or 5. And I remember asking the creators of the show, well, because my show was about the character Louis. I said, well, tell me about Louis. What's he like? They just shrugged. We don't know. You know, it's up to you. Write what you want.
Build him.
Look at the pilot and see what you come up with. And it was great. And so from there, I did a lot of other shows and went on to do my own shows. And it truly was the greatest age of television, and it breaks my heart to see what it's like today, because it was, I happened, after doing a few things, I got in with one of the greatest guys in TV at the time, Gary David Goldberg, and worked for him on Family Ties for many years and other shows, and he had a very enlightened view of women working at that time, and it was very rare. I was always the only woman in the room at the time, or girl, as I called it, because I was in my late 20s. Mm-hmm. And so, but the thing was, he had a very enlightened wife who, because of her, I will always credit Diana with Gary going out of his way to treat women equally and making sure that their perspective was seen in the script, which you didn't see that often. And I don't think it's that way now. I know there are still those mini rooms, and I don't know how many women are in them, but I do think they are more diverse. That's the only good thing about them. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's a crime. So anyway, I did a lot of shows, and until, good idea or bad, I had a couple of kids. And
I have an opinion on that.
But to shows. In fact, my older one, you were in an episode of a show of mine called Duet. And as I remember, you played the role of Bad Baby.
A role I was familiar with.
Yes, a role you were familiar with. And, you know, you actually got paid for that. Wow. And you never went anywhere with it, but that was...
Money I have not seen, so...
we saw it, you know. I think you made a grand total of like $350, which was not bad.
That's a lot in 80s dollars.
Yeah. And you and your brother, I think, remember growing up and coming to sets and having fun there and playing and everything. I mean, you can verify that.
I do. Yeah, that absolutely.
That
can fond memories.
Happen now. That can't right. happen. You know, when I think of bringing you to the shows and meeting you, everyone playing with you guys and everything, this is not what's going on now. And it's right. really, really wrong. Because in order to write a great show, you got to feel like you're with people you trust, and you trust what they're going to write, and you trust that they're going to, you know, tell you if it's not good what you write and or if it's great. And we're all there for one reason, and it's not the money. We're there to write the best show that we can and to make enough money. Back then, it was, you know, it was more money, so it was money to live well, but really what people need now is money to live.
Right.
They're not getting it. You know, this gig economy mini room thing it's not a surprise. Let's put it that way. It's been going on since 1931 in this industry.
Interesting. Well, yeah, just for some, you know, to explain to the writer or to the listeners what mini rooms are specifically, you know, they basically are they are the writers' rooms, but they are more instead of having one set of writers that works on a show throughout the course of a season or the course of an entire series, they do smaller, shorter-term contract writing, where they basically will have writers come in and either write a couple episodes or even just come in and write, you know, give some ideas, and then their contracts are expired and they move on, and the show will then hire another set of writers to write the next episode or come up with a few more ideas, and there's no continuity between the writers that may write the first episode of a season and the writers that may end up writing the final episode.
Exactly.
Am I correct on that? Yeah.
Well, sort of. I mean, even worse, what happens is writers are used to come in, and it's incredibly hard to break an entire season, although the seasons are far less now. You know, we did 22 episodes, and then to reward us or punish us, they usually gave us another couple because they liked Michael Fox and Family Ties or something.
Yeah.
But these, I don't know how many of these people do. So the people are brought in to work out the entire season, break down the story points and of each show, and do everything except write it completely. And then that falls to the person whose show it is. Not the studio or anything, but like the person who created the show. So they're doing all the work,
right,
and not getting paid anymore. Most of them are making good money. But then these other people who come in and do the really hard work, because we'd be there till 3 a.m. working out stories.
Right.
They come in and do that, and then they're gone. And they have no rights, and they make some money, and that's it. And so how are you invested in a show's quality? That's it. What's the big loser right now is quality.
Yeah, because there is like the big winner in this sort of the age of, you know, streaming is quantity. You know, there are a thousand shows that you can watch, and there's tons of different, you know, channels that are offering content, streaming services. But as you said, like there's it's very rare that there is one show that everyone is watching. You know, that's definitely used to be the case. There would be one time slot for, you know, all the seven networks, and people would watch that. You know, everyone would watch those shows. Or sorry, my numbers are probably wrong. That was four or five.
Four, seven.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, now it's hard to get everyone on the, you know, watching one show, and as a result, you have you know, hundreds of shows out there that people can choose from. But that means that there is, you know, probably a diluted quality of the writing that goes on, the ideas that are thrown into those shows.
Well, it's not only that; it's bad for society, because I remember, as a kid and as a teenager and as a young adult, rushing home to see a show and knowing everybody I knew who was like me and had my taste was going to be doing the same thing. It's all of that's gone. There's no event. You can watch a show whenever you want. So it's just like the rest of society. It's all been broken apart. You know, there's no sense of union, camaraderie, shared experience, you know, that stupid old phrase, gather around the water cooler in the morning and talk about it. And there's no gathering. There's a social media, which I think is the weirdest thing to call it, and people will talk, and then it'll be the same old bots coming and trying to sell you something. So that was a huge thing. You had it a little bit when you were growing up. You probably had it more, but it's not there anymore. There is no shared American experience, except maybe, what do people care about anymore that they'll watch all together?
Sports, I don't know. I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean,
people do.
Yeah. But you touched on an interesting idea there, that, you know, basically that there is a disconnect between the writers that are, you know, each set of writers that come in and the show that they're working for. Where, like, so in your time, you know, when you were working on any of the shows you worked on, you would have a set group of co-workers, of co-writers, and you would be responsible for the entirety of that show.
Exactly.
And you would feel a sense of ownership for it. And so therefore, like, you really put your heart and soul into how that show turned out, because it would be a reflection of you and your the quality of writer that you were and your group of people there.
And the room that I was in, we were all family members, so everyone wanted the same thing. It wasn't like that for everyone. You know, I happened to get lucky. And then when I went on to create my own shows, I wanted to make sure that the people were just as compatible as if they were great writers. Of course, they had to be really good writers, but I knew that would come. I always said I went to school at Paramount. You know, I learned it there, and they taught you there. I learned how to write, to edit, to go down on stage and, you know, direct, all that stuff.
Right.
People, they can't do that now. It's insane.
Right. And that I think that's a good point that you make, that like one of the major issues that is at, you know, that the writers are striking about and trying to sort of push back on right now is the idea that because there is no continuity of the writer's room for the shows that are producing, the writers themselves don't really have the ability to go visit the sets, meet with the directors and the actors and sort of help guide the script along. They essentially just write from some remote location, you know, and then they move on and they never get to really actually connect with the physical production of that show. Because I, you know, as you said, like I remember you and I remember going with you to the sets and you would be there as they were doing, you know, table reads. And then as they were actually filming, and if there was an issue with the way a joke was being delivered, or, you know, if there was the need to change the way that some, you know, line was written, you could see that happening and make the change that needed to happen.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you can't do now, but at that and not learning, you know.
Right.
It's like going to college and saying, okay, you can only take this logic course. That's it. Nothing else. So there's no advancement and there's no understanding of what goes into it and taking that into account when you're writing it. I mean, there were plenty of times that we would have, or I would have made a plot go differently and then realized, no, but that won't work because we only can do we can't do a swing set here, you know? So you got to know that. How are you going to know that?
Yeah. And that, I mean, so obviously that leads to a lessening of the quality of the end product, that the show that we all consume.
Right.
But it also, you know, for the worker side of it, it means that there's, as you said, like there's not a lot of opportunity for advancement, because one of the things that comes from being a writer in a room, you know, throughout the course of the entire show is that you go, you know, you work on the ideas, you go to the set, and you learn how, as you said, you learn how all the other jobs are done. You know, you learn what the director's doing, you learn what the showrunner's doing, and that means that you eventually are able to move up the ladder, if you so choose, to be able to run your own show eventually, like to be, go from being a writer to be a showrunner.
Right.
But that is
just
not even
as important. Yeah. I'm sorry to cut you off, but
no,
you're
please,
used to that by now. But it was just important to see the crew and see how they operated. And if you didn't have a happy crew there, you were not going to have a good show.
Yeah.
And that was so important. And you got to understand all of that, you know. Who's the most popular person on the set? It's always the craft service person who puts out all the food and candy. But, you know, as writers, the key was that we never leave this room. So all kinds of food was just thrown in at us whenever we wanted it. But it was fun. We always said it was like being at the kids' table. You know, we never had to be at the adults' table. So, but the point is, this has been going on since 1931.
Right.
And it has not changed from when there were a few Europeans who came out to Hollywood and started these, what do they call them, artist factories, where they felt they owned everything. They owned the entire business. And so this AMPAS that we all know of whenever you watch the Oscars, that was an association of the leaders of the owners of the studios, and they felt everybody who worked there from every aspect of the production was like their slaves. It was like a plantation, if you want to know the truth. People worked for them. They were under contract, you know, actors and writers, and you couldn't choose what you were going to do. And there came a time when writers just could not handle that. People like Dalton Trumbo, I'm sure you've heard of him, who was later blacklisted. A guild had to be formed. And it took 25 years from the beginning thought of it in the meetings until the first MBA, a minimum basic agreement, was reached. And that was in, 1951 or two. That's a long time. Or, sorry, 40. Did I say 50? 40. So, and that in all that time, exploitation was the name of the game. And it has not changed. I mean, the issues have changed, but not how, not what the major problem is. And it's always class. It's the people at top who have all the money who feel that they can control everyone else. And everyone else needs to eat and feed their families, and a lot of them just have to do it. There's not a lot of people who have the ability to go on a strike like all the writers. Now, we happen to have, the WGA has a great strike fund. I was involved in two or three strikes, and, you know, people who ran out of money, there was money there for them. Mm-hmm. Now I know that there's still money, and there's a lot of generous people who have made a lot of money donating. But take the average worker, the railroad workers. There's no strike fund. You know, it's all part of this crazy labor, not the labor movement, the labor suppression in this country. And it goes from the top. You know, where was Joe Biden when? Oh, never mind. But anyway, labor is being they're trying to stomp it down at every possible place, and it's the division of the classes is worse than it's ever been. It's never been good, but it is getting worse because there is more money than there ever has been due to tech, and the amount of people who want to take their money and do good are few and far between. It's all about buying more houses and bigger yachts and everything. You really see it if you live in Los Angeles and a lot of parts of the world.
And that's actually that's a good point that you're bringing up right there, that, like, you know, obviously, as it has been the case for basically any workers in any industry, we're now at a point where it used to be, being a writer, you know, once you did get hired to do a job, to work on a show, it was a job that could be your only job at that time. Like, it would be enough to for you to make a living and not have to do any side gigs if you didn't want to. Whereas now, because of the way that, you know, they've been squeezed so much, like, there are people who will be part of the hired for these mini rooms, and they will work, you know, work on a script or whatever, you know, work on some ideas in, you know, in their downtime while they're also having to go drive for Uber or, you know, work at a coffee shop or something like that at, you know, at the same time. So it does seem like even if you've reached what, you know, the layperson might view as the pinnacle of writing, you know, you are writing in Hollywood and you're writing for a television show, it still might not actually be something that is a gainfully gainful employment.
Right. And that's, you know, that's a crime, really, because it's all part of, you know, Reagan, when he got in, he was big on trickle down, you know, that the money would trickle down from the top. What I think he did was dumb down the society, and it shows now. You know, people, education has been decimated. People don't know history. They don't know what's going on. They don't know the struggles of the labor movements. And who's got time to worry about it? You know, you've got to make ends meet, and it's harder and harder and harder. And I hope that's not coming through.
It is, but it's all right. Maybe you can move your phone away. No, it's all right.
So, you know, to me, this is a way bigger issue than the writers. It is an issue of the breakdown of society in this country. It's more and more the rich and the poor, the middle class is gone. You know, I'm from, you know where I'm from. I'm from Detroit, the original labor town. Your great uncle was on the cover of Time magazine with Walter Reuther. So we have a history of labor unions. It was unthinkable not to have a union. That all changed in the 80s when Reagan broke the air traffic controllers. And it's all part of what is going on with the writers, and it's more important than just entertainment, which is, you know, can be great, but it's also mainly a diversion at this point. There's some absolutely wonderful things. I'm not putting that down, but a lot of it is to keep people home, binge watching something, and not realize that they're being exploited. Now I sound like an old socialist. I'm not that old, but I am an old hippie.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. Like, one of the things that I think goes, well, it doesn't go unsaid. I think the writers, WGA, is saying it, but, like, you know, the these studios are are largely trying to frame the struggle they're having with the writers as in like, well, look, we can't just be paying all of these writers, you know, like we can't continue to pay more and more for what the writers want. We can't meet all of their demands. But that ends up falling flat because it is basically the same thing that you see in any labor struggle. Like these studios are making record profits right now. Like they cannot claim poverty at this moment, that they can't afford a way, you know, residual increases or anything like that, because they are like, Netflix is an incredibly popular streaming service. Amazon obviously is owned by one of the richest men in the world. Like all of these studios are wildly successful, and yet they are still interested in squeezing, you know, all of their workers. Yeah.
I just want to get in a couple of stories. One of them is in 1931, you know, the country was starting the Great Depression. And so the studios were crying, oh, we can't afford, we've got to stop your wages. They actually wanted to freeze wages. We just can't. And you know, you got to help us out here or the studios will shut down and you're not going to get any money. At Paramount Pictures, where I spent the first part of my career, there was someone there named Irving Thalberg. There's a building named after him. And because of him, the wage freeze did not happen, because it was well known that he made in 1931 $4,000 a week, which in today's money is $79,500 a week. And they were trying to cut the wages of everyone who worked there. So that has not stopped. That's still going on.
Absolutely. So, I mean, a great addendum to that is that Adam Conover, you know, the host of Adam Ruins Everything, he pointed out in a CNN interview that the thousands of writers that are on strike are asking for roughly the same amount that the CEO of Warner Brothers Discovery took home in his pay just last year.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it is.
And
you
it's
know,
like that in every facet of society. I can't think of one facet where it's not. So,
yeah.
Now we have to touch on something. I don't know how much
time there. We have a few minutes.
This,
yeah, please.
This stunned me when I saw one of the last strike was 2008, and the big thing was the new media and getting paid for that. And everybody thinks it's great. You know, we got part of the new media, but residuals does not mean ownership. So we get residuals, but we didn't get ownership. Royalties never did. We didn't in the 30s either, 50s anyway. It's nice to get those green envelopes and get that money, but it could have been more. But anyway, the other thing I wanted to touch on is that, so new media, being a part of it, getting compensated for it, was in 2008 the big issue. The big issue today, I couldn't even believe it when I first saw it, is the first writer of any show shall be a human being.
Right, of course. Yeah.
Now, that's how far it's come. And of course, all of society is facing that. But see, it would be very easy to bring in some people into one of these mini rooms. They break out the whole season. They break down, they figure it out. And then you bring in AI and they can fill it in. They can fill in the dialogue. And then it can be punched up by the, you know, another group. So it is really a threat to not only the writers, but to everybody.
Yeah,
but
that
phrase, you know, that one sentence just floored me. that's how low we've sunk.
The first employee has to be a human. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that you're absolutely right that is, you know, it's not unique to this industry either. Like every industry in one way or another that has employees, human beings, is working on figuring out a way to reduce the number of human beings to zero that they have to pay.
Exactly. And then what are we going to be doing? I would just like to know. Because even waiters and waitresses are being replaced by mobile robots.
Yeah.
What are we supposed to do? I just don't get it.
Yeah,
is
absolutely.
Is Soylent Green? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I was in San Francisco recently, and you see a bunch of cars driving around with no one in the driver's seat. You know, all these.
What a metaphor.
Actually, really. But all these driving services are looking for ways to get rid of the human who actually does the driving for them.
Yeah, and so what's the plan? You know, that's what I want to know. Okay, one more thing.
Yes, please.
I just want you to understand what a big part of labor history you were. Because you were in the very first group of, how old were you, four or something, to go to the Paramount Daycare Center, which is the first on-lot daycare center for workers at that studio. And it was started by Gary, who I mentioned before, Gary David Goldberg. Rhea Perlman had a lot to do with it. And that was such an important, that kind of thing is so important. And that kind of thing is being done away with.
Yeah.
So
red diaper,
you,
baby.
You, Michael, you hated so much that I took you out and gave the spot to someone else. Just no appreciation that you could have been, you know, a big guy in the daycare center history.
I didn't know my future. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. We will have to leave it there. But thank you so much, Ruth Bennett and my mother, for joining us this week and discussing sort of the plight of writers in Hollywood and the strike, the ongoing strike right now, as well as the history of the writers' strikes throughout the 20th
Support
century.
Support people trying to make unions everywhere.
Absolutely.
Just follow what Bernie Sanders does.
Yeah. Well, we will have to leave it there. We will be back with you next month. Thank you so much for listening to Labor Radio. I have been Michael Cathcart. Have a great evening.
Bye.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! You're listening to KABU 90.7 FM.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Welcome to Prison Pipeline, produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. My guests are Larry Turner, co-founder of Fresh Out Community-Based Reentry Program, and Will Johnson, Fresh Out alumni and peer mentor. Welcome.
Hey, how's it going?
Glad to be here.
Larry, Fresh Out is a community-based reentry program that was formed by formerly incarcerated African-American individuals who saw a need to help other Black women and men who often release from prison